Ford dealt a major setback to the United Auto Workers Union. The company announced that it is planning to build its new Fiesta subcompact at a factory near Mexico City to be sold in the U.S. At least 7 people were injured, 1 critically, as more tornadoes touched down in Iowa. Iowa Public Radio's Joyce Russell reports.
The latest twisters hit several parts of the state. Most of the homes in the small town of Attica were damaged or destroyed, including a fire department building. A double-wide trailer was picked up and tossed into a nearby pond. Officials call it a miracle that no one died. High winds elsewhere downed power lines and pushed cars off roadways. Meanwhile, relief efforts are still underway following a tornado last weekend that tore through Parkersburg in eastern Iowa, killing 7 people and destroying hundreds of homes. Damage from that storm is now estimated at $6 million. Cleanup has been hampered by heavy rains as the severe weather continues. For NPR News, I'm Joyce Russell in Ames, Iowa.
A passenger plane crashed in Honduras today. At least 1 person on board the aircraft was killed. Authorities say the plane overshot a runway at Tegucigalpa Airport as it was trying to land and ended up in a city street. Local officials have long tried to revamp the aging airport, which has a short runway and antiquated navigation equipment. The hilly terrain around the airport makes its landing strip one of the most dangerous in the world. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up about 5 points to 12,651, and the NASDAQ is up about 15.5 at 2,523. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the Overbrook Foundation, supporting Catalog Choice, a service that allows customers to decide which catalogs to receive in the mail at catalogchoice.org.
It's summertime, 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 summertime,
sunscreen,
summertime, summertime, summertime,
picnic,
summertime, summertime, summertime,
radio,
summertime, summertime.
Before you head out to enjoy the summer, help WILL continue bringing you programs you depend on. Tune in June 6th for a summer celebration.
It's summertime, 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 summertime.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Provena Medical Group, where doctors treat people, not illness. More information available at 1-866-PROVENA. The physicians of Provena Medical Group encourage you to join them in supporting WILL. WILL programming is made possible by Columbia Street Roastery, roasting coffee daily at 24 East Columbia in Champaign. Also offering a variety of tea and chai. Open Monday through Friday from 9 a.m. to 5:15 p.m. and Saturday mornings from 9 to noon. More information is available at 352-9713.
It's 6 minutes past 1 o'clock. Today, the afternoon magazine features an interview from the AM 580 archives. Since it's a recorded interview, we won't be taking phone calls this afternoon. You're tuned to the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. We're online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. On the program today, we're going to go looking for Abraham Lincoln by talking about statues of our 16th president. There are close to 200 statues of Lincoln in the U.S. What did the statues mean to the people at the time of their unveiling, their dedication? What do they mean to us today? Our guide this afternoon, James Percoco. He is the author, most recently, of Summers with Lincoln, Looking for the Man in the Monuments. James Percoco is an award-winning history teacher. He's taught history at West Springfield High School in Springfield, Virginia, since 1980. The author of 3 books, he is a member of the Abraham Lincoln Bicentennial Commission's Advisory Board. For 4 summers, beginning in 2002, our guest began studying how Abraham Lincoln has been depicted in public sculpture. He concentrated his attention on sculptures created by sculptors who were born in the 19th century and those monuments whose dedication services included Civil War veterans. In his book, Summers with Lincoln, he has focused on seven statues that show the phases of Lincoln's life and identity. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest. In addition to Summers with Lincoln, James Percoco is the author of Divided We Stand, Teaching About Conflict in U.S. History, and A Passion for the Past, Creative Teaching of U.S. History. He's also the author of many articles. Summers with Lincoln is published by the Fordham University Press, and you'll find more about our guest at his website, www.jamesprococo.com, P-E-R-C-O-C-O. Mr. Percoco, welcome. How are you?
Good. How are you today?
I'm fine, thanks. Well, your interest, your passion for public sculpture goes back to your childhood. You want to tell us about that?
Sure. When I was a little kid, you know, talking toddler stage, I used to ask my mother to take me down to the local park when she'd walk me in the stroller to see the monument. And the monument was a memorial that was erected at the beginning of the 20th century to the veterans of the Spanish-American War and the Philippine Insurrection. And any time from that point forward, when I would be in the presence of figurative, what we would call academic sculpture, I always got really excited and jazzed up, and that played out well through my childhood. Have very, very fond memories of my dad taking me to the New York City World's Fair in 1964 and just repeatedly riding the conveyor belt that carried visitors in the Vatican Pavilion through a wonderfully, wonderfully lit room and looking at Michelangelo's Pietà. So there's always been this sort of energy between me and what on surface might seem to be a static object, but mm-hmm. when you really get into it, are not.
Yeah, it's very, Summers of Lincoln is a very interesting book. It's very, very good. What is it, do you suppose, about public monuments? Why do we have a desire for them? Why are we drawn to them?
Well, I think part of it has to do with our particular culture as Americans. All societies throughout history, irregardless of what continent those societies were on, you know, created monuments to their heroes. But there's a slight departure when you get to the United States, and part of that departure, I think, has to do, in fact, with Lincoln and his writings. And I think there's becomes in America sort of what we would call a civil religion, where we, because we don't have a state-professed, you know, religion, we have created a religion around our secular traditions, such as days of celebration and holiday, and around people who have delineated American life. And I think, you know, Lincoln is one of the first to sort of understand this in his verbiage, particularly when you look at his two great public papers, the Gettysburg Address and the Second Inaugural. It's laced with religious imagery, but Americans then take it to the next level by erecting these monuments. And the ultimate experience is, in Lincoln's case, going to the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C., and ascending those steps of Henry Bacon's Parthenon turned on its side to go into literally a temple-like structure, and there you venerate Lincoln at his feet.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an easy way to look at it. I mean, I think part of it has to do with the fact of how the United States was reacting psychologically after the Civil War and sort of the response to this terrific rending of American life and looking for a way in which we can pull heroes out of it. And the Confederacy would do the same thing. They would, their whole lost cause mentality would have tremendous religious overtones, even though there wasn't, say, a Godhead figure in the religious sense of the word.
Yeah. A question you ask in your preface is this. Do the statues of Lincoln portray him as a heroic yet imperfect man? Is the Lincoln we know more myth than man?
Well, that's a really good question, and that was a hard question to really answer as I went along the journey, because the journey for me over the four summers was not just a journey into Lincoln monuments, but it was into Lincoln himself. If you're going to study a subject in art that is based on a persona, you really need to understand that persona. And I read a whole bunch of books, different opinions of Lincoln, different perspectives of Lincoln. And I would say that probably in the case of the Lincoln Memorial in Washington by Daniel Chester French and the statue in Chicago by Augustus St. Gaudens, the standing Lincoln, I think in those two statues you have the very iconic sort of non-flawed person. You have sort of the great man who in so many ways can do no wrong. But then you come and you go to 1911 and you have Guts and Borglum's very different approach in Newark, New Jersey, of Lincoln, who's president, but he's a much more accessible president. He's the statue is low to the ground. It's constructed so that you can actually go and sit with it and get your photograph taken, as thousands of people have done since 1911. And there you get a more real Lincoln, a Lincoln who is deeply, deeply human and dealing with the carnage of leading a country through a war that's going to cost over 500,000 lives. In terms of Lincoln's flaws, I think what you need to understand is, like any figure, he's a figure of the particular age in which he lives, and the one area that people will chide him on, or actually the two areas that people will chide him on most clearly, are his early issues on race and some of the things that he said, particularly during the Lincoln-Douglas debates, and then clearly as president when he suspends civil liberties in an effort to, for what he would deem as military reasoning, keep the Union together. You're not going to get that so much out of any of these monuments, but what you are going to get, again, with the Borglum statue, is a deeply human person who's wrestling. And then maybe to some extent when you go to Cincinnati and you look at the statue by George Gray Barnard, which created a huge firestorm in the art world, probably not seen until 1980 when the Vietnam Veterans Memorial design was selected. You get more of sort of the rumpled kind of homespun hicky kind of Lincoln, and you could look at that and, you know, the editor of Art World, who vociferously came out against that statue, you know, called it a hobo Democrat and a calumny in bronze, and it was because of this sort of hicky kind of, you know, he would call it a Lincoln, a slouch. He called it a slouch of democracy. So your human characteristics, I think, are going to be drawn out most cognizantly in the statue in Cincinnati and the statue in Newark.
Yeah, you like that Cincinnati statue, and so does the historian Harold Holzer, who wrote the foreword to your book.
Yeah, I think that was the funnest chapter to write because there's a lot of colorful characters involved in the story. And I think what people need to understand with these monuments, as with any other kind of civic monument or memorial, there's always a history behind them. There's the story of the creation. And those stories of the creation often tell us what people at the time in which the memorial was dedicated are, where their mindset is. And what the Cincinnati statue did was, because the half-brother of William Howard Taft, Charles Taft, had made arrangements for a duplicate cast of that statue to be given to England as a gift of friendship, as the United States was moving closer and closer to active participation as a belligerent in World War I. People on one side of the argument, led by Ruxtel of Art World, who wrote six very scathing editorials against it, you know, railed against the statue, particularly because it was going to go as a gift. It was going to be the exportable Lincoln. This was the Lincoln we were going to send to London to be placed outside of Parliament. And the argument came down to, is this the Lincoln we want to export? On the other side, you had George Gray Barnard, obviously the sculptor, who was all for it for self-serving reasons. And then you had him employing people like Ida Tarbell, who was one of Lincoln's earlier biographers. She's best known as a muckraker, but she, at the turn of the 20th century, writes a several-volume biography of Abraham Lincoln. And he enlists her, and he enlists the Lincoln poet Edward Markham, and there's this sort of newspaper war that goes back and forth between Art World and a magazine called Outlook and a magazine called Touchstone, where they're arguing about the merits of this piece. And you have Tarbell and Markham on one side saying, this is the Lincoln of democracy. This is the man of the people. This is the common man. This is who we are. And then you have Ruxtel, who then gets the assistance of Robert Lincoln to just attack it and the attacks get really personal on Barnard, and you get all the kinds of color that comes out of these tales, and it goes on and on and on for about 7 or 8 months until finally it's decided that the statue that will represent the United States in London will be a duplicate cast of the St. Gaudens statue in Chicago, and then the duplicate cast of the Barnard statue will go to Manchester, England, which is a industrial town. It's the Lincoln family. It's where their lineage goes to. And interestingly, Manchester was a city that during the Civil War voluntarily shut down its textile mills to support the emancipation of slaves in the United States. And Lincoln would get in a very nice correspondence with the leader of the textile industry in Manchester, and there would be correspondence between the two of them. So in that way, it kind of works. But for me, the fun thing was looking at how all these people looked at one man and saw multiple sides and then claimed that they were the rightful heirs to the legacy of or memory of Abraham Lincoln.
Yeah. And how do the people of Manchester feel about that statue? Do you know?
They love it.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's great. I mean, Lincoln is no longer, just doesn't belong to the United States anymore. He's one of those people that is really a figure of worldwide significance. And there's been all kinds of stories about, you know, Leo Tolstoy going into the Caucasus and people wanting to know about the great leader. And when he finally realized who they're talking about, he goes into the town and he gets a picture of Lincoln and he brings it back to show everybody. And so Lincoln is really somebody who's a citizen of the world, I think, at this stage, more than just a citizen of the United States. And I think the cities that honor him do so because of their fraternal arrangement with the United States. Although, interestingly, in China, in the People's Republic of China, they are very open in their admiration of Abraham Lincoln. And Mao's mausoleum is deliberately copied on the Lincoln Memorial.
Interesting. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Historian James Prococo is our guest this afternoon. He's the author most recently of Summers with Lincoln, Looking for the Man in the Monuments. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. The first monument you focus on in Summers with Lincoln is today a controversial one. Actually, it was controversial, I guess, going back almost all the way to the beginning. It is Thomas Ball's Emancipation Group Freedoms Monument. Would you describe it for us?
Sure. The Thomas Ball statue is in Lincoln Park. It's one of the early Lincoln statues that falls in the genre of Lincoln as the Great Emancipator, which was the first stage of monumental Lincolns that begin to appear and populate the American landscape. And what it shows is Abraham Lincoln standing erect. In his right hand, he holds a copy of the Emancipation Proclamation. His hand and arm rests on a podium, which has a bas-relief medallion of George Washington on it. And then directly in front of Lincoln is a crouching African-American figure who's wearing a loincloth, and in his hand he holds a broken shackle. And the idea is that this is the symbolic moment in Ball's conception of the moment of emancipation, where Lincoln is the great emancipator, almost in a benediction kind of posture, waves his hand over the manumitted figure, and the figure is in the act of rising with the broken shackle in his hand. And at that time, it was, you know, the African-American community which paid for it, the former slaves and members of the United States colored troops and African-American veterans paid for it, but they had no say in the design. They were very happy with the fact that they had the statue of Lincoln and that they were part of the artistic composition. But Frederick Douglass, in an offhand remark from the from the speaker's podium, because he was the keynote speaker, he offhandedly remarked to somebody that he didn't think the figure was very manly. But there was a sense on that day, April 14th, 1876, that their moment had come. In other words, that the relationship between Lincoln and a black man was finally seen in a public gesture in a public civic monument.
Why did the people who paid for the monument, why didn't they have a role in its design?
Well, I think it has to do with, for a couple of reasons. One, I think, has to do with expediency. When the statue was not commissioned, per se, by the African-American community. What it was Thomas Ball was an expatriate American artist living and working in Rome. And on a train ride through Europe, after Lincoln's assassination, he gets word that Lincoln's been killed. And he goes to a studio in Florence, and he works out his grief composing this small reduction, what we would call a reduction now, or a small model, of this idea of Lincoln freeing a slave. And that's in 1865-66. It's not until the end of that decade that the Western Sanitary Commission, which is an organization headquartered in St. Louis, which was one of the various sanitary commissions that helped veterans and dealt with their spiritual needs and their physical needs during and after the war, they become the purse string. They become the organization that holds the money of the donations that come streaming in from the African-American community. And what ends up happening is it becomes a rather paternalistic kind of relationship where, okay, we'll take the money. We know we know what you want. We know what's best for you. We know what needs to be done. And it's when one of the members of the Sanitary Commission is traveling through Europe and goes and visits Ball in his studio, and he sees the model and he says, "This is really pleasing." And so then begin negotiations between the Western Sanitary Commission and Thomas Ball, and eventually the statue is put up in a larger size, sent to, it's actually was cast in Munich, Germany, and then shipped to the United States. So I think it was a matter of expediency, that they didn't need to hold a competition to sort of deal with issues that come up. When you have a competition, they had a design that they thought seemed to strike the moment, the mood, and that's what they went with.
Now, you went to D.C. to see the sculpture with some former students, and you tell the story in the book. It's really, really a lively discussion came as a result of seeing this sculpture. Would you tell us about these students and what their thoughts were about the monument? Give us some sense of that discussion that you had.
Well, these were I teach a specialized history class that I've been teaching for 17 years called Applied History, where it's a special class, it's a senior elective, and in this class we look at issues in history, we look at topics in history, we don't look at history in a chronology. And that's in the first semester when we're in the classroom. And then in the second semester, these students go and work as interns at different historic sites in the D.C. area, like Ford's Theater, Arlington House, Mount Vernon, Gunston Hall. And it's a very public history kind of class where we're looking at issues throughout the whole year in themes like public memory. You know, one of the places that they have to go visit is the Holocaust Museum, and we look at, you know, what's Holocaust memory, and what's the difference between memory and history. And there's also a very strong sort of Civil War, Civil Rights Movement kind of connection in this course, where I take students through sort of looking at how those events have been mirrored and are connected and are portrayed in our history. And that happened to be the year that was also the 40th anniversary of the events of Bloody Sunday and the march from Selma to Montgomery, Alabama. So we did a bus trip down to Selma for the 40th anniversary, and we're on the Edmund Pettus Bridge, you know, with 10,000 other people singing civil rights songs and meeting people like, you know, John Lewis and other leaders of the civil rights movement, talking with them. And what ended up happening is when we came back, you know, as I was writing my manuscript, they said this would be really cool to get, you know, to draw out my students. So we, one day after graduation, six of us went down there and we just started talking about Lincoln's memory and this whole issue of race and how the kids were very upset, you know, that the funders had no call over the design. And part of that struggle is what I think Americans deal with in any kind of historical construct or interpretation, and that is, you know, presentism, putting our values and using our values to judge people in the past. And that's what much of the conversation was about, was looking at how could they have done this, why would they have done this, and why didn't the black community speak out against it? And so our conversation was very lively and very animated and, you know, looking at the design and picking the design apart and looking at sort of some of the singular things about the design. For example, unless you hop up on the pedestal, you can't really see that there's behind Lincoln, there's a broken lash that's also a symbol of the end of slavery, and it's leaning against a whipping post in which is now being covered with what looks to be like roses and rose petals. And so we looked at sort of what does that say about the monument.
Mm-hmm.
Is the monument really a fair monument? And it was just a great, lively discussion.
Yeah, one of your students talked about the roses, and I think it was a young woman, and she said, well, roses also come with thorns.
Right, right. And that was Michelle, and of all the students that day, she was the quietest one, but that was really kind of her telling moment, because she makes the connection between, you know, roses are pretty, but, you know, if you play around with them, you're going to get stuck.
Yeah. What kinds of things were said that day in terms of, to use your words, how we construct our history, particularly in public space?
Well, I think you have to understand these are pretty savvy, you know, individual kids, and what I think they understood was that, you know, history, you know, when we teach history in a traditional survey course, whether it's U.S. history or world history or whatever, you know, we're stuck by what's known as the timeline model, where you start at point A and you end at point B. And part of what I try to do with my students is to look at, all right, well, who decides what gets to be put on the timeline? For example, one of the things I use to make a point is after the Battle of Little Bighorn, the American press said there are no survivors. Well, that's absurd. There were survivors, the Indians. So what do you mean there's no survivors? And how does our story get told, and why does it take so long for people that have been on the margins of American history to get their stories incorporated into the general public understanding of history as well as in school curriculums? I mean, the way I was taught history as a high school student back in the 1970s is very different from the way that I teach it today, because so much has happened since the 1970s that has taken on sort of the top-down, dead white male version of history. I think more and more schools are doing an integrated curriculum in terms of what I would define as the lost voices, men, women, social history, looking at topics in history that haven't been explored in the past, race, those kinds of things. But I think one of the things we talked about with the students that day was this idea of, you know, who are the stakeholders and why do the stakeholders get to choose what they are, and what do the stakeholders at the end of the 19th century say versus about American life and culture, versus what do we as stakeholders today at the beginning of the 21st century say about our history, and who are the ones that are making decisions? And this is where I think history becomes an argument without end or an ongoing conversation, because as I've watched how curriculums have been shaped and changed over the last generation, that argument, that sort of getting people put into the curriculum that have been left out, has been a very strident force by many people, many of the more recent generation of scholars than, say, people who were writing post-World War II up through the early 1960s. And the whole idea is to look at, again, as I said, who makes these decisions? Why do the power brokers get to make those decisions, and what allows them to get away with that? I mean, we all agreed there's no way a sculptor today would ever try that kind of composition in a monument to Abraham Lincoln. There's just no way. I mean, then the other question becomes, okay, well, if the monument is offensive to people, then why don't we take it down? Well, I think you have to. What you have to do is, I think you have to set it in context, and I think you have to interpret it, saying this is an artifact of a particular time and place in America. This monument was saying something to Americans at that moment in time. It speaks to us today with very, very different sensibilities, and we bring our sensibilities now into the things that we want to create for people to remember the times in which we live.
Yeah. As I mentioned, the foreword for the book was written by historian Harold Holzer, and in it he tells the story of the dedication of a recent Lincoln monument, the first public Lincoln statue in the South, dedicated in 2003 in Richmond, Virginia, which was the capital of the Confederacy. And Holzer spoke at the dedication. Maybe tell us briefly what happened, and I think this underlines what you've just been talking about.
Well, you know, that was a really interesting story, and again, that's a story that's going to get told and told and told again, because it gets to the nub of what we've just been discussing. And that is, what happened was, the National Park Service was expanding its Richmond National Battlefield programs, and they were building a new visitor center at the Tredegar Iron Works, which was the former arsenal and armory of the Confederacy. And they wanted to put a statue up of Abraham Lincoln to reflect that Lincoln came to Richmond a week before he was assassinated to visit Richmond, to see what had happened to Richmond. And he walks through the devastation of Richmond. Not in his hand is a sword or a weapon, but in his hand is the hand of his 10-year-old son, Tad. And this is unheard of. This is the conqueror of the South, and he's not riding in on a steed. He's coming to town, walking through the town, holding the hand of his 10-year-old son. And the National Park Service wanted to have a monument that would echo that theme. So you have this sculpture by David Frey of Lincoln on a bench, sitting next to his son, putting his arm around his son. And the idea, again, would be like the statue of Borglum in Newark, which I think this one is modeled on. I think it drew some inspiration from that. People can come and sit with Lincoln and be photographed. And you had a hue and cry because in the South you still have the vestiges of this, you know, the Confederacy, and we don't want to, we want to protect Confederate heritage, and we don't want to deal with the issue of what the Confederacy was fighting for or what they were defending, albeit that Confederate supporters say, well, they were really fighting for states' rights. I fall into the argument, well, yeah, but at the kernel of states' rights was this issue of maintaining your institution of slavery. And neo-Confederate organizations and organizations like the Sons of the Confederate Veterans and the United Daughters of the Confederacy, which at the end of the 19th and the beginning of the 20th century erected all kinds of monuments to Confederate heroes throughout the South, which absolutely enraged Frederick Douglass, they staged a protest. They showed up at the dedication with placards and signs that said, Hitler, Paris, 1940, Lincoln, Richmond, 1865, any questions? Mm-hmm. Or they rented a plane that flew one of those banners off the back of it, like you would see at the beach, an advertising banner that had flying behind it the words "Sic Semper Tyrannis," which is the state motto of Virginia, "Thus unto tyrants," and it's also the words that John Wilkes Booth yelled as he jumped off the stage at Ford's Theater after putting a bullet into Lincoln's head. You had all kinds of people showing up in Confederate gear. They actually had a separate service in Hollywood Cemetery at the grave of Jefferson Davis, and essentially, carried on in this way to draw attention to themselves, which had an effect of drawing more attention to the statue, which got interest in the statue generated and launched a lot of people in a conversation about, again, Lincoln in memory, well over 100 years after his passing.
Yeah. Historian James Prococo is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. He is the author of Summers with Lincoln, Looking for the Man in the Monuments. We've got a couple of listeners who would like to join us now. So first we're going to go to a caller on line one. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi.
You might be interested in this. At the University of Kansas in their museum, there stands a stuffed horse. And it happens to be Comanche, who was Custer's horse. And when Comanche died, they stuffed him and put him in the museum. And there was a sign there that said, "Last Survivor of the Battle of the Bighorn." And the Indian students who were at the University of Kansas would go by there and say, "That's not right, because my grandfather survived the Battle of the Bighorn." And so they had to remove the sign, which I think is a delightful story. And I'll take your comment off on air.
Thanks for the call.
That's a great story. And, you know, Little Bighorn is probably the most contested battle site in the United States. Within the last 8 years, the Indian nations of the United States who participated in the Battle of Little Bighorn actually got to erect a monument there on the battlefield. And that caused an equal uproar. There are Custer files. When Congress changed the name of the battlefield in the 1990s from Custer Battlefield National Monument to Little Bighorn National Monument, people had fits. These iconic figures who become burned in sort of the retina of our memory bring with them baggage. And what I mean by baggage is they bring with them the things of the time, and people. Oftentimes, people don't want to look at that. They just want to look at the heroic. They want to look at the icon. They don't want to deal with the other side of the story. And I think it's important when you teach history that you demonstrate that there's another side to the story. And one of the books I have my students read is a book by Edward Linenthal called "Preserving Memory: The Struggle to Create America's Holocaust Memorial Museum," because in the creation of that museum, you were dealing with all kinds of memories, and you were dealing with not only Jewish memory, but you were dealing with Armenian memory, and you were dealing with Romanian memory, and you were dealing with Gypsy memory, and you know there was a fight. I mean, there was an internal division over, okay, who were victims of the Holocaust, and you had a number of Jewish people saying it was only Jews, and if you represent other people, you denigrate the memory of the Jews killed in the Holocaust. So these are very dicey, tricky debates, but I think they're debates that have to be held. They have to be brought out to the public. And I think we as Americans there's this kind of notion that, you know, Americans don't like their history or they're not interested in their history. You touch on any of these subjects that rub somebody raw, and there's a lot of excitement that can fly out of it.
Let's take another call. A listener on line two. Good afternoon.
Hi.
Hi.
Reference to this, I believe it's James Lowen that did the book Lies My Teacher Taught Me. I think he also did a book where he traveled around and looked at monuments and tried to sort of deconstruct their misapprehensions of American history. I don't know if you use that as well.
Yes, I have.
Yeah. Well, he's, by the way, for Celeste, he's going to be in town and beginning of April for a conference talking about his new book,
okay.
Sundown Towns, and I don't know if you've had outreach by them yet to have him on the air, but that's a very fascinating topic, which I think you might have covered once before, too. But anyway, I wanted to contest this idea of presentism a little bit, because there were radical abolitionists at the time who did share some of the opinions that we would say are quite modern. So, I just, one can't entirely excuse the past for not being the present, it seems, particularly when one looks at the history and sees that there were people that had more egalitarian notions. Now, according to this book, Forced into Glory.
Right, by Lerone Bennett.
Yeah, he documents that Lincoln sort of kept money going into this Negro removal office even after the radical Republicans had scotched the funding for it. So he had the idea that people were equal, but only in their own lands in some way. So there's a undermining of the it's a little clay under the feet of the statue there. But I find it fascinating, and I think it needs to be at least reflected a bit. You might want to contest. I had another point, which is maybe I'll just mention that and then hang up, which is you referred to this abridgment of civil liberties that Lincoln did. We hear the current what's called Party of Lincoln saying, well, look at what Abe Lincoln did, but he had a constitutional basis for it. I mean, the suspension of habeas corpus is written into the Constitution under times of rebellion and attack. So if that wasn't a rebellion, I don't know what was. So you can't excuse that bit of the present from the past. So thank you. I'll listen.
Okay, if I could take the question about civil liberties. The issue that people take on with the question of civil liberties is, yes, it is in the Constitution that you have the right, that the government has the right to abridge those in times of rebellion or discord. The issue is that it's a power that's given to Congress specifically in Article 2. It's not a presidential power, and what Lincoln does with that is he invokes it early because Congress is not going to get back until July of 1861 before they're going to be able to discuss it, and he jumps on it. And I think most historians that I've read, including Daniel Farber of the University of Chicago, who wrote a wonderful book about Lincoln and the Constitution, they take Lincoln on for that. I mean, that was pretty bold stuff that he was doing. And again, he won the war, so looking back, we can say, well, he was right. I mean, but the Union won the war and went on. I would like to also address the question of presentism, because that's something that I also struggle with. And I struggle with it most poignantly over the legacy of Thomas Jefferson, because it seems the more and more I read about Thomas Jefferson and what scholars are writing today, it gets harder and harder to defend Jefferson in a lot of things that he does. And, you know, here's another venerated great American icon who clearly maintained the institution of slavery. Clearly the reason he can't free his slaves upon his death is he's incurred so much debt because of his spending habits, which were extreme, that when you look at Jefferson, you read other writings of Jefferson, letters and documents where he takes on the institution of slavery, and yet he doesn't do anything about it. He doesn't, you know, he can't do anything about it, but he almost looks the other way when it comes down to him. So I think the issue of presentism is something that all generations in history who look at history are going to struggle with, because we bring to our particular view of history the baggage that we carry as individuals from the past to those interpretations that we have.
Hmm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, historian James Prococo. We're talking with him about his book, Summers with Lincoln, Looking for the Man in the Monuments. My name is Celeste Quinn. We have about 5 minutes left in this portion of the program. If you'd like to join us with a question, give us a call, 333-9455. That's the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Another of the statues you focus on is one I suspect some, if not many, of our listeners will know. It is in Chicago, and it is one of the sculptures featured on the jacket of your book. It is Lincoln standing, dedicated on a rainy October day in 1887 in Chicago. And it, I believe it stands near the Chicago Historical Society. Am I?
Yes, you're right.
Right on that? Okay.
You are correct.
Okay. And you see this statue as Lincoln as statesman. Why do you think it is a powerful statement of Lincoln, and why did you include it?
Well, I think I included it two reasons. Number one, the sculptor, Augustus St. Gaudens, is probably a name that folks aren't too familiar with in terms of our cultural cast of characters in our history, but he's a really important person. In fact, there's just been a major new documentary film made about the life of St. Gaudens by palmmaker Paul Sanderson. It's a wonderful, wonderful film. And St. Gaudens is key here, because St. Gaudens, in his greatest works, is able to literally transform bronze or marble into flesh and blood. His greatest works have this kind of singular energy that emanate from it. And the other reason that the statue is included is because up until the dedication of the standing Lincoln in 1887, that is the period before it in terms of Lincoln iconography, Lincoln memory. Lincoln the Great Emancipator is the one who is being celebrated. St. Gaudens' statue, it's very clear that there's a change now, that we are now going to honor Lincoln the statesman, Lincoln the unifier. In fact, there are actual there's actually newspaper accounts saying no longer must we deal with Lincoln the great emancipator, but now we have the beau ideal of Lincoln the great American statesman. And what St. Gaudens does in that piece is if you stand at that piece and you look at it for a long time, and one of the things in dealing with sculpture is it takes time to learn to look to see what makes a sculpture work. There is a kind of, as I said before, an energy that emanates as if Lincoln is actually in the process of getting up from that chair of state, which provides the necessary volume to give you a sense of space, and he's moving forward. His left hand is on his lapel. His head is bowed. His right arm is tucked under the back of his spine, and it's almost as if he's about to utter something. And there's just this kind of grabbing. It just grabs you. And St. Gaudens was great in his five or six masterpieces. He was absolutely a master of being able to transform metal into life. And I think that's what happens in that particular statue there, that there's a certain sense of animation that is transcended through the bronze. And that's what gives it. There is emotion there. You go to the statue of Lincoln in the Lincoln Memorial by Daniel Chester French. He's seated. He's static. But the standing Lincoln in Chicago, it's in motion. And you can literally see it and feel it.
Let's take one more call before we run out of time, and we'll have to wrap it up, though, pretty quickly here. Line one. Nope. A caller's gone. So, well, talk with us just to wrap up here about what your advice would be to us now as we've been listening to you, and hopefully some people will get out and read your book. But in terms of looking at a statue and thinking thoughtfully about it.
Well, gave a great segue there, because the word you talked about, thoughtfully thinking about it, the German word for monument is Denkmal, which means thought object. And these monuments that were built, that were created, dedicated in the late 19th, early 20th century, they were dedicated in the horse and buggy age. So these statues, unless you go to, say, the Standing Lincoln in Chicago or the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, those are clearly destination monuments. Those are monuments in which you have to enter the memorial space. I would hope that when people, after they read my book, would understand that the technical aspects that go into sculpting, that monuments in our public squares are not simply purchased for pigeons, that they have a memory, that they reflect somebody's creative bent, that they have a story behind them. We're a great nation for building. I mean, we have monuments all over the country now to all kinds of groups of people. I think it's our most democratic form of artwork, because we have monuments to women and African Americans and Native Americans. That they understand that these people, while they're memorialized in bronze or stone, that they still were human beings. They struggled, they worried, they had their flaws, their shortcomings, but somehow somebody found them or what they did worthy of remembering.
And that was James Prococo in an archived interview from March with Celeste Quinn on the Afternoon Magazine. Celeste Quinn returns on Monday. I'm Jay Pierce. Thanks to our technical director, Jason Croft, and the producer of the Afternoon Magazine, Harriet Williamson. We'll have to end the archived interview there and move on to the commodity market highs, lows, and settlements for the day. And here's Dave Dickey.
Jay, and good afternoon, everyone. Well, to finish the work week, it was another volatile and hectic day at the Chicago Board of Trade. 4 days of trading this week. And if you were looking just at the July soybean contract, for instance, you would have saw these swings: up 40 and a quarter, down 50, up 25, and down 20 and a quarter from today all the way back to last Tuesday. And so it's been a yo-yo type week, and yet when the week was all said and done, July beans ending the week down just 4.5. We'll have to discuss the volatility at 2:06 with Mike Zuzulo of Risk Management Commodities in Lafayette, Indiana. Let's go ahead and look at the day's trading. And we'll begin in Kansas City with July wheat, which had a high price on the day of 8.03, a low of 7.89, settling 8.02 up 8. December, a high of 8.36, a low of 8.22 and a quarter, settling 8.36 up 9. July wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade, a high of 7.65, a low of 7.39 and 3 quarters, settling 7.61 and a half up 18. September, 7.81 for the high, the low 7.56, settling 7.77 and a half up 18 and a quarter. December, a high of 8.02 and a half, a low of 7.79, settling 7.79 and a quarter up 18 and a quarter. March of 2009, a high of 8.20, a low of 7.98 and a quarter, settling 8.19 up 18 and one half. May of 2009, a high of 8.23 and three quarters, a low of 8.12, settling 8.31 up 19. July, a high of 8.40, a low of 8.18, settling 8.38 and a half, up 16 and a half. December of 2009, a high of 8.68 and three quarters, a low of 8.50, settling 8.68 and a half, up 16 and a half. July corn, a high of 6.03 and a quarter, a low of 5.77, settling 5.99 and a quarter, up 17. September, a high of 6.16, a low of 5.90, settling 6.12 and a half, up 17 and a quarter. December, a high of 6.30, a low of 6.03 and a quarter, settling 6.26 and a half, up 17. March of 2009, a high of 6.43 and a half, a low of 6.16 and three quarters, settling 6.40, up 17. May, a high of 6.50 and three quarters, a low of 6.25, settling 6.48 and a half, up 16 and three quarters. July, a high of 6.58, a low of 6.33, settling 6.54 and three quarters, up 16 and one half. Take it out to December of 2009, a high of 6.05, a low of 5.89, settling 5.96 and a half, up one and a half. July oats, a high of 384 and a half, a low of 375, settling 382, unchanged. September, a high of 394 and a half, a low of 386 and a half, settling 394, up a half. July soybeans, a high of 1365, a low of 1308, settling 1363 and a half, up 40 and three quarters. August, a high of 1370 and a half, a low of 1315, settling 1368 and three quarters, up 40 and a half. September, a high of 1358, a low of 1310, settling 1356 and a quarter, up 34 and a quarter. November, a high of 1356, a low of 1306 and a quarter, settling 1354 and a half, up 33. January of 2009, a high of 1367 and a quarter, a low of 1324, settling 1368 and a half, up 33. March, a high of 1378 and a half, a low of 1333, settling 1379 and a quarter, up 32 and three quarters. May, a high of 1385, a low of 1340 and a half, settling 1385 and three quarters, up 32 and three quarters. And July of 2009, a high of 1394, a low of 1356 and a half, settling 1395 and a half, up 33. Let's go all the way out to July of 2010, show you where their settlements are. A high there at 1350, a low of 1335, settling 1360, up 20. July soybean meal, a high of 346.20, a low of 329.20, settling 341.50, up 970. August, a high of 348.50, a low of 334, settling 344.10, up 950. July soybean oil, a high of 61.38, a low of 59.56, settling 61.31, up 101. August, a high of 61.70, a low of $60, settling 61.66, up 101 on the day. We'll have settlement prices in just a moment from the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. This is Dave Dickey.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Brady Allison in Champaign at 217-378-7633. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
And in a minute before 2 o'clock, we need to mention a tornado watch is now in effect for the entire WILL severe weather coverage area till 10 o'clock tonight. Tornado watch till 10 for all of the counties in our severe weather coverage area. As many numbers as we can from the Merck now, June live cattle had a high of 96.60, a low of 95.65, settled at 96.52.5, up 57.5 today. August had a high of 101.90, a low of 100.85, and a settlement at 101.85, up 92.5. We'll go to the August feeder cattle now. 116.45 was the high, 115.47.5 the low, 116.02.5 the settlement, up 57.